It's Champlain Valley Game Night on 101.3 ESPN. Presented by the Windjammer Restaurant and Upper Deck Pub. Local, fresh, and Burlington's original steak and seafood restaurant. Now, here's your host, Brady Farkas.
What's up, everybody? Brady Farkas, Champlain Valley Game Night right here, 101.3 ESPN, 101.3ESPN.com. Also, always on the 101.3 ESPN app, which is a free download in the Google Play Store. Also, in the Apple iTunes Store, you can find everything you want right there, including full show podcasts. You can listen live. You can listen on your Amazon Echo as well by saying enable 101.3 ESPN. And then once you've done it one time, just say open 101.3 ESPN. Obviously, things are going to change starting Tuesday. We will be known henceforward as 101.3 The Game. If you have the 101.3 ESPN app, it will give you an update, as far as I know, telling you, hey, you can click this link to download the new updated link or the new updated app. You will be able to do everything else that you've been able to do. Again, those full show podcasts, listen live, scores, news, notes, web content, interviews that we've done, everything that you want. We go up until 7 o'clock, full show today, and then it's Red Sox baseball, 7:25. They take the airwaves against the Chicago White Sox from the south side of Chicago. We'll have the lineups for you in that one as well. Excited to announce that next Thursday, which is September 6th, we will have our first remote broadcast as 101.3 The Game. We'll be broadcasting live from Plattsburgh State. We'll be broadcasting live from the athletic facilities there right outside Memorial Hall where the basketball team plays. We will have our first new huddle of our new time slot out live, 3 to 6. We will be there. We'll also be giving away, get this, we'll be giving away a set of men's hockey season tickets. We'll also be giving away a set of women's hockey season tickets. And that is nearly a $400 value between the two. Those men's hockey tickets, season tickets, are $140 a person. We're giving them to you for free. Come out and see us at Plattsburgh State again next Thursday, September 6th. It will be the first time we are out as 101.3 The Game. As for what's coming up today, I'll get you ready for Pat's Giants kickoff less than an hour from now. Thoughts on Odell Beckham Jr., big ESPN story on him from this week. The Dave Dombrowski haters are out. We'll get into that. And author Jeff Perlman will stop by at 6:40 as well. You can always get in on the Town Fair Tire text line, 802-655-6672. Jalen Ramsey had a lot to say. Jalen Ramsey frequently has a lot to say. He talked about the Patriots. He talked about Gronk. He talked about Danny Amendola. Not a whole lot of it glowing. We've talked a lot about them. First off, though, before we get into what he said and if I agree or not, I have to love the comments. I do. I have to love that he said them. I don't have to agree. I don't have to appreciate them, but I do appreciate that he spoke his mind, because this is a thought process that really has evolved for me over the last 5-6 years. If I was 18, 19, and I heard an athlete say this, especially an athlete who wasn't on my favorite team, I'd roll my eyes and be like, come on, dude, like, win something before you pop off. That's how I would have looked at this when I was younger. As I've gotten older, and as I've gotten into this business, I now just appreciate athletes who give you anything. It's not about necessarily getting one great soundbite. I'm not in interviews. I'm not in talking to athletes for one great soundbite. If you get it, great, but so be it. I just want people who are interesting. I don't have to like what someone says. I don't have to agree with it, but give me something that's interesting. Give me something that's honest. I remember, talking to guys at the Super Bowl who I didn't think were huge names and thinking how great they were because they were actually open and honest and engaging and interesting. When we had Johnny Manziel on a couple of weeks ago, I thought he was fascinating. We've had Ryan Leaf on, and they're willing to talk about the demons that they've battled. I respect that. They could easily just, go into a shell of themselves. They could easily not give you everything, but they let you in to how they're feeling, and I appreciate that. And for all the times we hear about athletes being cliche and, we take it one game at a time. Oh, it's a long season. Oh, everybody's banged up right now. This guy's given you, he's given you his honest opinion. You don't have to like it. You don't have to agree with it. But I do like it because I appreciate someone who speaks their mind. And in a world where people are afraid to speak their mind because you're worried about, and oftentimes I think rightfully so, when you're worried about what you do and what the negative impact or what the backlash could be and what it might have on you, you don't want to give your, you don't want to say it. You don't want to give it. You don't want to give everything. You don't want to bear all. Jalen Ramsey does it. So before I decipher what he said, before I try to decode it, then I have to just say, I love it. I appreciate it. I appreciated it when Richard Sherman did it. I appreciate it when Ocho Cinco did it. I appreciate it when T.O. did it. Now I look back on some of those guys. I'm like, you know what? I like that they said it. I don't have to agree with it. I like that they said it. Now, as for what Jalen Ramsey said, he talked bad about the Patriots. He talked bad about the AFC title game, about Gronk, and about Danny Amendola. And Danny Amendola's not on the team anymore. Obviously, he signed that free agent deal with the Dolphins. But his comments about Amendola are really where I found myself getting offended most. Now, maybe I should have been more offended his comments about Gronk. He's not as good as we think he is. Maybe I should have been more offended about his comments about the AFC title game. Oh, the refs gave him the title, but I'm more offended by what he said about Danny Amendola. And what he said was, his exact quotes were, he just got a brand new contract and he is terrible. People think he's so great. No, he's not. Tom Brady made him look good. Tom could take me as a receiver and I'd be a first team all pro. What he's saying is that Tom Brady elevates Danny Amendola and he has this false, you know, portrayal as being a really good player. And Ramsey says he's not. I have a problem with a comment like that. And the reason why is, do I think that Danny Amendola has as much talent as Randy Moss? No. Do I think that Danny Amendola is the second coming of Julio Jones? No, I don't. But it's okay to be in a position where you are elevated by the people around you. That is what is supposed to happen. We have put an athlete like Tom Brady, like LeBron James, we have put those guys on pedestals. We have said they are or they're darn close to being the best to ever do it. And part of the prerequisite for being the best to ever do it, there seems to be a checklist that people have to go through. One, you have to have great personal accolades. You have to have great individual awards. Both guys have won MVPs. They check those boxes. They have to have accomplished team goals. Tom Brady's won 5 championships. LeBron James has won multiple championships. He's won 3. LeBron has won gold medals. They check those boxes. But they also have to have this other caveat of they make people around them better. That is what's supposed to happen. Do I think that Danny Amendola will put up the same level of productivity with Ryan Tannehill this year as he did with Tom Brady? No, I don't. That doesn't mean that Danny Amendola is terrible, though, as Jalen Ramsey said. That means that Tom Brady did exactly what great players are supposed to do. We have said, in order to be a great player, you have to elevate those around you. That's what Tom Brady does, and Danny Amendola might be a perfect example of that. But why is that a bad thing? Not everybody can be Randy Moss. Some people do need to be propped up by who they're around. Other people are brought down by who is around them. Phillip Rivers is, by all accounts, a great quarterback. He hasn't won Super Bowls. Why? Maybe sometimes the talent around him wasn't as good. There were other years where it was, LaDainian Tomlinson and Antonio Gates. But there are other years where it wasn't. And you know what? You can't help who's around you. All you can do is try to elevate those who are. Tom Brady's done that. Danny Amendola is a beneficiary of that. I don't see a problem with that. Don't we say that all the time about players? I remember it perfectly. We talk about the Lakers. LeBron James signs with the Lakers. And I remember the day after saying that when he... I remember the day after LeBron signed with the Lakers, coming in and reading the statistics that said, hey, LeBron James, when he played last year with Cleveland, there was a list of 7 or 8 players that all of their shooting percentages were better off a LeBron James pass than any other player. Why? LeBron draws double teams. He draws help defenders. He gets you open looks because people are now crashing. People are so focused on LeBron that others get good shots. Kyle Korver, Kevin Love, J.R. Smith, Jordan Clarkson, Rodney Hood, all of those guys were elevated by the play of LeBron James. We don't crush them for that. We say, wow, that guy plays with LeBron. He's going to get an awesome chance to benefit from being around LeBron. It's what we say about the Lakers. Hey, The Lakers didn't win on their own this year. Lonzo Ball didn't take the Lakers to the playoffs. Kyle Kuzma didn't take the Lakers to the playoffs. But now they get to play with LeBron, and we just instantly assume LeBron's going to make them better. He's going to take the pressure off. He's going to create better shots. He's going to be a better leader. All of those players are expected to be elevated by LeBron James. And that is perfectly okay. That is perfectly acceptable. We expect that out of LeBron, and we expect a byproduct of LeBron's greatness to be better play by all of those other pieces. Why is that not okay in the NFL to Jalen Ramsey? Again, I appreciate that he was honest, and I appreciate that he believes it and he has conviction behind what he says. But isn't it okay for Danny Amendola to benefit from Tom Brady's greatness? For Amendola's sake, he's just capitalizing on playing with a great player, which is what we want and expect all other players to do. I don't need him to be Randy Moss. I need him to be good with Tom Brady. And he was. And he elevated himself at the big moments when Tom Brady elevated himself. I don't look at that and say Danny Amendola's terrible. I don't look at it and say Danny Amendola just rode Tom Brady's coattails. I say that together, they were able to do great things. Great things in Super Bowls, great things in AFC title games, great things in playoff games, great things on third down. Danny Amendola put himself in the right position, and he had the right guy playing with him to be successful. If he doesn't play well in Miami, I'm going to say, yeah, he's playing with a lesser quarterback. That doesn't make Danny Amendola not good. It means that he's no longer in as good a position to succeed. So I love that Ramsey said it, but I found myself getting most offended by the Patriot that's not even on the roster anymore. 802-655-6672 is the number on the Town Fair Tire text line. You can always get in going up until 7 o'clock. Jeff Perlman, author, noted author, is going to join us at about 6:40. Talk about his new book on the USFL, the connection between the USFL and President Trump back long before he was President Donald Trump. We'll talk about that. He's written a lot of really, really good stuff, a lot of big stuff, a lot of notable stuff as well. Red Sox baseball goes up until 7 o'clock over on 9, or Red Sox baseball comes on at 7:25. Over at 7 o'clock over on 960 is Patriots-Giants in the final preseason game. I'm ready for the preseason to be over because I'm ready for the regular season to start. And now as we've got week one of college football this week and some big matchups, it's really going to feel like football season. So I'm going to be really, really itching for the next 7 days to get to the regular season. But I still think that tonight is must-watch TV for me as far as the Patriots go. If I'm a Patriot fan, tonight is must-watch TV because I think there's so many things that need to be ironed out about this team. I'm not in Arnie's camp. I don't think they're destined for 9-7. But I do think there's some real question marks about this team, and hopefully I can get more of them answered tonight. How much is Julian Edelman going to play? Is he going to play zero snaps? Or is he going to play the whole game? I think that's a fascinating debate. And we're starting to see a list of some people who look like they're going to be inactive and all that. We're starting to get those out. But intern Nick, maybe you can tell us if you see anything on Edelman playing tonight, but if we have an official word yet. But it's a fascinating debate because Julian Edelman is obviously coming off an injury. He needs those repetitions to play. He's going to be suspended for the first 4 games. You'd like to think that this guy who is coming off an injury, he could use repetitions. He's also not going to play for the first 4 weeks. Therefore, this is his last game action for more than a month. He could use repetitions. But because he's coming off an injury, what are his limitations? How much is he able to play if Bill Belichick wants him to? Tom Brady, when facing his suspension for Deflategate, played 39 snaps the last preseason game. Brandon Browner was suspended for first 4 games. He played 51 snaps. What does Julian Edelman play today? Do they want him to play at all? And if so, how much does he play? How much does he play with a lesser quarterback that's not Tom Brady? Speaking of that, Danny Etling today. You took him in the 7th round. I crushed the Patriots for that. The Patriots, to me, wasted a draft pick on Danny Etling. I don't know that he makes this team. And if he does, he certainly plays no role this season on this team, unless the absolute unthinkable happens and both Brady and Hoyer get hurt. But he's fighting for a roster spot tonight. He's fighting for maybe a spot on the practice squad tonight. What do we see out of him? Does Brian Hoyer play? Can he show me something that leads me to believe that he's a capable backup? Because right now I just assume, oh, Brian Hoyer's a guy that knows the system. But I don't think very highly of Brian Hoyer. What do we see out of him against the Giants? Does Jason McCourty line up at safety? Yesterday we talked about him getting cut at corner. They put him at safety a couple times last week. Do they play him again? Does that save his roster spot? It looks like Mike Gillislee and Jeremy Hill aren't playing today. Does that mean they're both guaranteed roster spots? And if it does that mean that Rex Burkhead and Sony Michel aren't healthy enough for the regular season, so they need Hill and Gillislee? Those are questions I want to hear talked about in the broadcast. What do you want to see today out of the final preseason game? Let us know. Town Fair Tire text line. As for the Giants, they don't have as many interesting things to me. We kind of know where we're at in a lot of ways with New York. The two things that I really want to see tonight out of the Giants, one is the backup quarterback battle. Davis Webb, where does he stand? How does he look? Remember how awful he looked week one against the Browns in the preseason. Kyle LaLetta, the kid they took out of Richmond in the fourth round, how does he look? Who looked a little bit overwhelmed in his early preseason action. How far have they come since week one, which was the last time I sat down and made a point to watch every snap of a Giants preseason game? How do they look? And who's taking Olivier Vernon's spot? Because Olivier Vernon's got that ankle sprain. He might not play week one against Jacksonville. He's your most disruptive member of the front seven. He's one of the most disruptive members of front seven in all of football. If he doesn't play week one, I might start seeing who's going to fill his shoes here tonight. Maybe Lorenzo Carter, the kid they took out of Georgia. Maybe they have some different packages that get, you know, in James Betcher's new defense that can help alleviate Vernon. Maybe I see some of those guys today. So, look, it might not matter in terms of who wins and loses, and it might not matter to you, the fan, as to, oh, it's Patriots-Giants, it's a rivalry. Don't look at it from that perspective. Look at it that both teams have questions. Both teams have questions that need answering. Champlain Valley Game Night right here on 101.3 ESPN at 101.3ESPN.com. Red Sox take on the White Sox tonight. The Dave Dombrowski haters are coming out of the woodwork. Are they correct? Well, that's next. Champlain Valley Game Night, 101.3 ESPN.
Brady has no one to disagree with him. So why don't you get in now on the Town Fair Tire text line at 802-655-6672. It's Champlain Valley Game Night on 101.3 ESPN at 101.3ESPN.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Champlain Valley Game Night right here, 101.3 ESPN, 101.3ESPN.com. Going up until 7 o'clock, but then we have Red Sox baseball coming up at 7:25. We got intern Nick running the board today, so this is, I don't know that it's going to be an adventure. Intern Nick seems to have his head on straight, so hopefully he doesn't mess up. Nick, did you find anything out about Julian Edelman officially? I saw a report that said he's the number one punt returner, and then I saw one that said that he wasn't going to play. So I think he's going to be in there tonight. There seems to be no reason to hold Edelman back, right?
All I saw on Twitter was that he was throwing the ball around or hanging out with Odell Beckham Jr. and Tom Brady. So
I saw Odell Beckham Jr. throw a 65-yard pass.
Oh,
today in warmups. So that's
maybe
what
he's the Giants quarterback of the future. Who knows?
It looks like Edelman's going to play. Zach Cox of Nesson has him listed as the top punt returner on the roster right now for the night. So it looks like Braxton Berrios is going to play as well. A guy that we've talked about, he is has not played since the Redskins game. So Berrios looks like he'll be out there tonight. The punt returners appear to be Edelman and Riley McCarron in there too. Cyrus Jones also in there. So, well, if we see it, but you know how it goes preseason week four. You know how it goes into preseason in general. We never know who's playing until game time. But Edelman, I think, is a fascinating case. Nick, your first task here, make sure you eject that music that just played, because if you don't, it's going to play again. So this is your first time on the board. So I gotta coach you as I go through. So that's the right button, and then
there
you want to eject the one that says spot block above it too. This is coaching on the fly here. So
okay.
Dan in Middlebury says, is Amendola worth the money? Did Miami make a mistake? I say yes. Now, I think he got $8 million. That's off the top of my head. So I would say that they overpaid for Danny Amendola. I would say that. But at the same time, I think you have to go in and temper your expectations. I'm not asking Danny Amendola to play on the outside and catch 100 balls for 1,400 yards. I'm asking him to play in the slot, do what he does along with Devontae Parker and guys that they have there, and they signed Albert Wilson, the kid from who was in Kansas City previously. I'm asking all of them to catch anywhere between 65 and 80 balls. I'm not asking one of them to be Randy Moss. I would say, yes, it's an overpay if you're expecting him to come in and be Randy Moss, if you're expecting him to come in and be Julio Jones, if you're expecting him to be a valued member of the team who can solidify your passing offense in high pressure downs, I would say you have a good player for that. How that translates monetarily, yeah, it feels like it's a bit of a stretch. It feels like it's more than the Patriots had to spend. It is more than the Patriots had to spend. But also remember that the NFL has a rule where you have to spend, you know, 90% of your cap over a three-year span. So you have to be able to do that. I do want to get to the Red Sox. The Dave Dombrowski haters are out of the woodwork. Evan Drellick yesterday of NBC Sports Boston, I would say ripped is too strong a word, but had some harsh thoughts about Dave Dombrowski. The Red Sox bullpen has struggled. Tyler Thornburg hasn't been great since coming back from thoracic outlet syndrome. Matt Barnes has struggled lately. The team's walk rate is incredibly high. The Red Sox have walked. They're ranked 20th out of 30 in walk rate. Craig Kimbrell has struggled at times. He blew the save the other night, even though they came back and won. So Evan Drellick came out and said that you are seeing the deficiencies in Dave Dombrowski now. He did not correctly plan for this. He did not go out and get another bullpen arm. He did not. He just anticipated that Craig Kimbrell was a lock to be as good as he was last year. He didn't go out and add at the deadline because he didn't anticipate for regression of Matt Barnes. He didn't anticipate for regression of Joe Kelly. And he has said, this is why you keep prospects, because the Red Sox have nobody to lean on, they have nobody to bring up, and they have nobody that they can go and trade for, and they have no prospects to give. That's why they couldn't get a Kelvin Herrera. That's why they couldn't go and get a Brad Hand. That is what Evan Drellick said. We asked Buster Olney about it yesterday on the huddle, and we said, Buster, is that criticism of Dombrowski fair that Drellick had? So this is what Buster told us yesterday.
Put it this way, I think the only way that you can have that view is if you thought it was a good, it would be if you thought it was a bad thing that they traded for Chris Sale and they traded for Craig Kimbrell and they signed JD Martinez and they made all these other moves. If you said that along the way, then you have the right to say that. Short of that, then you can't, because let's face it, that's the reason why they're in. When Dave took over the Red Sox, they were considered to have maybe the deepest farm system in baseball, and he's used those resources to get the likes of Sale, to sign David Price, to make all those moves. And look, I mean, that's his history. He's aggressive. He spends the credit card.
This is what bothers me about sports media. And Nick, maybe it bothers you as you get into this business, but this is what bothers me about sports media, that everything, that debate has become so much a part of this business that you forget that there's a gray area within a lot of things. I don't think you have to look at this and say, oh, Evan Drellick's right, and oh, Buster Olney's right, and you have to take a side. I don't believe that. I think there is a side in the middle to this, and this is what I have said all along. Anyone who's listened for the last 6 months knows that I have been hard on Dave Dombrowski. I believe in prospects. It's no secret. I like prospects, and maybe it's because my own team has lost so much that prospects are all I have to get excited about, and you feel invested when you hear about these guys at 20 and you follow them up the ranks, and by 24 you're ready for them to be great. Maybe that's all part of it. I believe in prospects. I believe in young talent. I believe in affordable talent. I believe in utilizing the draft, international signing, the minor league system to build up your organization, and then using free agency to supplement it, not try to cover up for deficiencies. Think about it like the NBA. The Golden State Warriors got really good through the draft. Okay, Steph Curry, Draymond Green, Klay Thompson, that core came through the draft. You know what the New York Knicks did a few years ago? They said, hey, we can't draft. We'll just go sign Derrick Rose, and we'll go sign Brandon Jennings, we'll go sign Joakim Noah, and we'll try to be good. And you know what happened? The Knicks won about 30 games, and oh, yet again, they missed the playoffs. And oh, now they're saddled with salary problems. That means they suck for another 3 or 4 years. So I don't believe in trying to build teams like that. Look at why the Yankees have gotten good again. Why? It wasn't all about, they got rid of the guys that they overspent on. The A.J. Burnett's, the Mark Teixeira contract, A-Rod's contract, Brian McCann they traded. They traded Aroldis Chapman and got prospects like Gleyber Torres. They traded away Andrew Miller and got prospects. So that is why they're good. They are good now because they have a farm system that they have replenished, and those young players are playing well and they're affordable. And then they can go out and add supplements in free agency. They could go get Sonny Gray. Now, I know you don't think Sonny Gray is good now, but at the time, we all loved the move. They could use prospects to go get him. That is why they've been good. I have been harder on Dave Dombrowski than anyone in this building about how he's handled the farm system. But it doesn't have to be one way or the other. I have been saying this from the start. Red Sox fans just need to be aware at this sense of urgency to win. Dave Dombrowski has put this team in an incredible spot to win this year. To win this year and next year, I would say. I would argue the window stays for next year, too. He has put them in an incredible position to try to win a World Series. He's gotten you Chris Sale, a top-flight pitcher. He's gotten you a Cy Young-caliber pitcher. He brought in David Price a few years ago, who now is starting to look like the David Price you expected, albeit 2 years after you got him. He's gone out. He acquired Craig Kimbrell, who's been a premier closer in this game for a long time. He's been a premier closer with the Red Sox since almost day one that they brought him in, last month or so of struggles notwithstanding. He's brought in all of that talent. He acquired Ian Kinsler, a perennial, I think 20 homers and 10 steals for 10 straight years or something like that. I mean, he's given you a chance. The moves that he has made over the last 2 years, they have put you in a position to have the best record in baseball. I do not think that it is fair to go and crucify Dave Dombrowski now. And as far as Evandrelik's comment goes about, and we've had Evandrelik on, and I appreciate his work, but as far as his comments go about, oh, he didn't anticipate regression with Craig Kimbrell. He didn't try to fix the bullpen. Well, he did. He went out and traded for Tyler Thornburg last year. That was supposed to be your big move.
Right.
Beyond that, I understand it. And I said they should add to the bullpen too, but I understand they don't have the pieces. The reason they don't have the pieces is because they went and did all these other things. So it doesn't have to be Evandrelik's right or Buster Olney's right. This just Red Sox fans need to be aware. You are trading potentially a 10-year great run like the Yankees have for a one or two-year great run. And, I mean, Nick, you're a Red Sox fan. You're a diehard Red Sox fan. If I tell you the Red Sox win the World Series this year, but then after that, they're not in a position to win the World Series for another 7 years, would you take it?
I don't know. Yes or no, probably yes. But I think with this situation, you look at how the Yankees are pretty much guaranteed to be a powerhouse for the next 5 to 10 years.
But the Yankees missed the playoffs for a couple of years.
Right. But
so I'm asking, is it worth it? If I tell you the Red Sox will win the World Series this year, so the move to trade Yoan Moncada works out. The move to trade Manuel Margot to get Craig Kimbrell, that you win the World Series. But then the cliff comes, and the cliff is coming.
Right.
So Chris Sale might not be able to be re-signed. If he is, he could turn into a shell of himself down the line as he gets older. Craig Kimbrell is going to be gone in free agency as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
You're going to lose Drew Pomeranz in free agency, who you don't want back, but you traded prospects for.
Right, a really good prospect at that.
You're going to lose, I think, out of Sale, Kimbrell, Betts, Bogarts, and Bradley, I guarantee you you're losing two of them, and it might be three of them.
Yeah,
I think you're losing Kimbrell for sure.
Yep.
I think you're losing Bradley for sure, and Betts is the swing one. As far as I'm concerned,
I don't even know if Betts is the swing one. I would say either Sale or Bogarts is more of the swing one.
Rob Bradford of WEEI does not think that Betts will be back. He thinks there was irreparable harm done to the two sides' relationship over the arbitration thing. So I think Betts is the swing one. Now,
yeah, that's fair.
And I believe Bogarts becomes a free agent 1 year earlier than Betts, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
So they have to make the decision on him.
Right.
So they have to make that decision first, and I think they'll go for him. But,
probably, yeah.
But nonetheless, the cliff is coming.
Yep.
So I'm just saying that for Evan, I think it's a little too doomsday for Drelick to say what Dombrowski's done is a bad thing, because they put you in this position where you can win this year. What I'm saying is the sense of urgency is so real, because then it goes to what Evandrelik said. So right. I'm asking you as a fan, look, if they win this year, But in order to win this year, they've compromised a lot of the future. Are you okay with that?
I mean, yeah, I'll take the World Series, but I mean, obviously you don't ever want to see your team go through dry spells, but I mean, look at Houston, Philadelphia, even the Yankees. I mean, they went through those dry spells and now they're up again. So, and they're better than they've been in a long time. So, I really think that the Red Sox right now are a lot like the Yankees of like 2008, 2009 when they went out, spent all that money, then it kind of fell apart and they were bad for 3-4 years and now they've got those prospects again. I think that's what the Red Sox will likely end up being over the next 10 years.
I still think that's different because those Red Sox teams, the Red Sox now, they do have homegrown talent on this roster. So when we talk about the Red Sox having a bad farm system, and maybe the thing that I haven't even portrayed right is they did graduate out a lot of talent of that farm system who was with them. Benintendi was in the farm system. Betts, Bogarts, Bradley, they were all, Swihart, they were all in the farm system at one point that was so good. They didn't just trade everybody. Some of those guys just came on the team and are contributing. Those Yankee teams had nobody.
Yeah.
Outside of Jeter, I mean, who are we talking about that was a homegrown talent on the 08 and 09 Yankees? Cano.
Yep.
I'll give you that. So Cano and Jeter.
Well, I mean, you still had Posada and Rivera sticking around at that point. So,
but we're talking about 15 years earlier.
Right. I get what you're saying. Yeah, Pettit. But
Cano is the only, and Gardner. Cano and Gardner are the only two that we're looking at that World Series team and saying those were young talents that the Yankees had at that time. Everybody else was bought and paid for.
Right. Yeah, but I don't know. I think that the Red Sox, I think as time goes on, I think that even though the situation's a little bit different right now, I think the Red Sox are going to follow that similar path is what I'm saying.
The thing that I think we're all in agreement on is if the Red Sox don't win the World Series this year or next year when they have everybody, then it becomes a massive failure.
Then it costs that, Dombrowski his job, honestly.
That's where it becomes a massive failure. And that is where me, Evan Jurelik, those that have piled on getting rid of prospects, that's when you come out of the woodwork.
Right.
If they win the World Series this year or next year, when Sale's there and you know you've got all the young talent right in their prime, they win the World Series, then you come back and you laugh at prospect guy like me and you say, hey, man, we won the World Series. How's holding on to your prospects doing for the Mariners? Nothing. If they don't win the World Series, that's where I come out of the woodwork and say, well, hey, you took your shot, you missed, and now you're headed for another 7-8 years of mediocrity. You know who the Yankees remind me of? The Yankees remind me of the Celtics. Okay? The Yankees could have traded Gleyber Torres for Noah Syndergaard. Yep. They could have traded Gleyber Torres for Jacob deGrom. They could have gone way more after it and sacrificed some of their young talent. They could have traded for Manny Machado if they thought it was an upgrade over who they had currently.
Right.
They could have done those things, but they didn't. They held on to the young players. Much in the same way the Celtics could have gotten Kawhi Leonard. Now, they would have had Kawhi Leonard for 1 year. They would have had Kyrie Irving guaranteed for 1 year.
Yep.
And they would have lost Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. Maybe that Celtic team with Hayward, Leonard, and Irving would be better for 1 year than that team with Brown and Tatum there.
Right.
But if you don't win with that team and those guys leave in free agency, you've now lost them and the young studs.
Yeah.
And that's where it becomes the problem. So, again, I've been hard on Dave Dombrowski. I don't know that we could fully judge his tenure until you see what happens in the next 2 years. Because I've used this comparison before. If they win the World Series, then all is forgiven. Yeah. If they don't win the World Series, they become what the Detroit Tigers are now. The Detroit Tigers is the franchise that Dave Dombrowski left behind.
Right.
And remember those Tiger teams? They got to the ALCS a couple years in a row. They got to the World Series against the Giants.
Yep.
And now what are we looking at in Detroit? You're looking at no Justin Verlander. You're looking at Miguel Cabrera money that's still going to cripple the... I mean, the guy can't even play.
Yeah.
Still going to cripple the franchise. Victor Martinez can't even walk. Ian Kinsler had that big money there. Prince Fielder had that big money there. And there's not a lot left in that Tigers cupboard. And here they are sitting... I mean, I think they're in third place because the White Sox and Royals are so bad.
Yeah.
But in any normal year, they're probably one of the worst teams in baseball.
Yeah. And if you don't have no farm system to back it up either.
If you don't win the World Series, like those Tigers teams didn't, and you become that, then it becomes a problem. All right, we got to take a break because Jeff Perlman, noted author of a new book on the USFL, he is going to join us. He's going to do it next on Champlain Valley Game Night on 101.3 ESPN.
It's a Champlain Valley game night with Brady Farkas, and you can be part of the show by texting in at 802-655-6672. So join the conversation now on 101.3 ESPN.
Welcome back to Champlain Valley Game Night right here, 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. Going up until 7 o'clock, full show today. Red Sox baseball starts their coverage 7:25 as they get ready for Game 1 of a series with the Chicago White Sox. But now let's go out to the TikTok Jewelers guest line where we find ourselves Jeff Perlman, noted author, author of several great books, including this one that just has come out called Football for a Buck, a book on the USFL, and you've also written about Brett Favre, the Showtime Lakers, Roger Clemens, and countless others. Jeff, how are you?
I'm use the adjective noted, so I'm pretty happy.
Well, hey, that's better than unknown.
Yeah, or some of the things I'm called in my house by my kids. I'm pretty psyched about that.
Well, Jeff, again, the new book, Football for a Buck, a book about the USFL. Why did you want to write about the USFL?
I mean, so I'm 46. And when I was 10 years old, the USFL was starting its first season. And I just love the league. Like, love as much as you can love anything in sports. And, you know, a lot of that is, like, sort of how we are when we're kids. And you see something new and shiny and bright. And I remember seeing Herschel Walker on the cover of Sports Illustrated in his New Jersey Generals uniform and just being blown away. So, for years and years, I was fascinated by the league and all the names, Steve Young and Jim Kelly and Herschel and Reggie White. And this grand experiment of challenging the NFL with spring football. I just was always, I loved it as a kid. I was fascinated by it as an adult. I always wanted to write about it, and I ignored everyone who said I shouldn't and just decided to do it.
You know, Jeff, it's funny you say you're 46. I'm 28, so I didn't live through the USFL. My knowledge of it is from the 30 for 30 that came out a few years ago. Explain to me and the younger audience, what made the USFL so successful?
Okay. See, successful would be the wrong adjective. Because it only lasted 3 years, right? But it was marvelous, right? It was at a time when the NFL felt kind of stilted and a little boring, and you know, they weren't allowing the players to express themselves. And the USFL comes along, and it's like, okay, we're going to be a spring football league. We're going to have coaches' challenges. We're going to have 2-point conversions. We're going to allow juniors, because Herschel Walker came out after his junior year to sign with the USFL, and at the time, the NFL did not allow that. You could not have underclassmen sign. And then they were like, and they had like, this is going to sound corny, but they had crazy neon kind of uniforms and explosive names, and they were popping up in weird markets. Like literally, the San Antonio Gunslingers were a team. You know, the Oklahoma Outlaws. And then they started drafting guys, and they scared the crap out of the NFL because they started signing all these guys who were, you know, first-round NFL talent. Craig James from SMU, Herschel Walker, Kelvin Bryant, Steve Young, Jim Kelly, Reggie White, on and on and on. So they terrified, absolutely terrified the NFL.
Jeff, it's funny you say these things about, oh, they had the wacky rules, they had the bright jerseys, they were in weird markets. Did the USFL really just do what the XFL tried to do? Because that's what it feels like to me. It sounds like you're describing the XFL, just one that lasted longer than 1 year.
No, I actually would say they tried to do what the NFL finally decided to do. Like, the USFL had a team in Jacksonville. That was the first time the NFL thought of it. The USFL had a team in Tennessee. First time the NFL thought of it. You know, allowing players to express themselves. You know, later you saw different teams, you know, with the touchdown dances and the sort of moonwalking in the end zone, all that stuff. That all came straight out of the USFL. So I think what the league really did, two great things for players. Number one, the salaries exploded because you actually had an alternative to signing with the NFL, the way they would give you big money. And the other thing they did is they allow players to be themselves. They allow players to brag and boast and talk trash and dance in the end zone. So I think the NFL ended up doing a lot of what the USFL said, you know, here's a way football should be.
Jeff Perlman, noted author, Football for a Buck, a book on the USFL, with us here at Champlain Valley Game Night, 101.3 ESPN and 101.3ESPN.com. What caused the undoing of the USFL?
I'll give you a hint. It rhymes with Donald Trump.
Yeah. explain that more.
Donald Trump was the owner of the New Jersey Generals. And I want to say for the record, this has nothing to do with your current political leanings one way or another. It truly doesn't. Donald Trump buys into the USFL in 1984. He buys the New Jersey Generals after one season. He enters and he's all about spring football. This is great. I love the USFL. I love what they're doing. I'm really excited to be a part of it. And as soon as he gets to Generals, we need to move to fall. This is a joke. We need to be a fall fool. We need to take on the NFL head-to-head. And his whole motive, his whole motivation was to get an NFL franchise. He'd been rejected by the Baltimore Colts in a bid to buy them. So in 1984, he actually arranges a secret meeting with the commissioner of the NFL, Pete Rozelle, at the Pierre Hotel in New York City, and says, you know, to Rozelle, I don't really care about the USFL. I'll do whatever it takes to get in the NFL. That means blowing up this league. That's fine. I don't care. It was all a tool to him to getting into the NFL. And one of the greatest sort of, if you want to know why Donald Trump is so angry about the NFL and has been for years and years, Pete Rozelle in that meeting says to him, as long as I am commissioner of the NFL, you and your family will have nothing to do with my league. Never, ever, ever. Because he just saw Trump as kind of this con man, this smooth talker, new money. And the move to fall and the ultimate decision to sue the NFL killed the USFL.
So I guess, that was my question. So does Trump move or, you know, help spearhead the move to the league to the fall just solely because he's so bitter about the NFL that he wants to beat it head on in its own season? He couldn't just be okay with scaring the hell out of them in the spring?
No, he wanted to be a part of them. Like, he wanted to be in the NFL, and he saw a move to fall. He thought one of two things would happen. He thought, number one, they sue the NFL, and what ultimately becomes is a merger. And okay. You have to remember, the New York Jets at that time had moved to New Jersey to play in the Meadowlands to share with the Giants. So there was no team in New York City. He was convinced that a team in the Generals would become the New York Generals, and they would just be absorbed by the NFL. Or, worst-case scenario, they sue the NFL for antitrust violations. They win, and then the USFL was flush with money, and ultimately a merger of some sort happened. So he... And it wasn't without logic, some of the planning, but it was a huge disaster. It's one of the great, truly, he never talks about it. It's one thing he never talks about. It's one of the great failures of his business career, you know.
Really? And so, Jeff, when I hear things now about, you know, that we've got the Alliance of American Football starting and the XFL is coming back, is there any hope for a league at this point that isn't the NFL in the way that there was hope for a league back in the early to mid-80s?
I think so. I think the Alliance looks like a prayer. They know what they're doing. And you just can't make the mistakes USFL did. Number one, you're not going to take the NFL on directly. It's just not going to happen, so don't do it. Play in the spring. Number two, you can't spend outlandishly. You know, don't try stealing players from the NFL. Don't try drafting guys who are going to be the, you know, top picks in the draft. Just don't do that. And three, keep it regional. If you have a team in Florida, this is what the USFL did very wisely. If you have a team in Florida, fill them up with guys from Florida State, Miami, Bethune-Cookman, all the different schools there. You know, across the board. And I think they're doing that. And I think as long as they keep it sort of minor league level, they have a shot.
How is the quality of play in the USFL beyond the star players? You mentioned the Reggie Whites and the Jim Kellys and the Steve Youngs. How were the rest of the rosters filled out? What was the overall quality of play?
So 83 the first year, very hit or miss. 84 the second year, much better. 85 the third year, fantastic. And again, you're talking about a lot of guys who went to the USFL. They started picking off a ton of NFL players. So, like, you know, Brian Seip, who'd been the 1980 MVP with Cleveland, Kansas City starting safety, Gary Barbaro. Like, there are a million guys like that who went to the NFL. So, by the end of it, it wasn't, you know, the best, I would say the two best teams in the USFL were the Michigan Panthers and the Philadelphia Stars. I would say both of those teams were probably 500 NFL teams.
Hmm.
So, good quality, very good quality.
Jeff Perlman, author with us here on Champlain Valley Game Night, 101.3 ESPN, 101.3ESPN.com. As I said, you've written about the USFL. You've written about Brett Favre. I remember that book, Gunslinger, the Showtime Lakers, Roger Clemens. What are the other stories you want to tell? What's the next frontier for you?
I mean, my dream book has nothing to do with your show. So I really want to write Tupac Shakur's biography.
Really?
Yeah.
But you got to find out what happened first. Every time I see a thing on USA, A&E, I never get the answer.
I know. He's my favorite performer of all time. I just think it'd be a great, great book. Allow me to step out of sports a little. So hopefully you'll have me back in Vermont to talk Tupac.
Yeah, that would be. We actually, it's funny you mentioned that. We had an autograph authentication remote recently, and somebody brought in a Tupac autograph. It turned out to be fake. I was crushed.
Killer.
Jeff, we appreciate it, man. Thank you so much. The book is great. It's called, again, Football for a Buck is a book on the USFL. A lot of our listeners will remember the USFL fondly, and a lot of the things that are in that book help you understand why Donald Trump is the way that Donald Trump is towards the NFL. I think that's fascinating also. Jeff, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
All right, there he goes, Jeff Perlman. Wow, Nick, you let me go way too long with him. That'll do it for us. For intern Nick, Rich and Arnie in the huddle, I'm Brady. We'll see you tomorrow on a Friday, everybody. It's 101.3 ESPN.